From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. AIDS is caused by a virus, so is the common cold, and so are a wide variety of afflictions, great and small. On this edition of Fresh Air, medical writer Ann Fettner explains what viruses are and why they're so hard to destroy. Larry Brown never went to college, and until this year, he worked as a fireman in Mississippi. But for the past 10 years, when he wasn't fighting fires, he was teaching himself to write. The results are winning rave reviews. Coming up, Brown joins us for an interview and reading. World music critic Milo Miles reviews Paul Simon's album, The Rhythm of the Saints. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg examines what happens when Americans try to sound like highbrow Brits. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. President Bush has asked Secretary of State James Baker to go to Saudi Arabia early next month for a general discussion of the Persian Gulf crisis with Saudi leaders. The White House said it is not true that Baker will ask the Saudis to approve military action against Iraq. Presidential spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said no date has been set for the trip. A trip to the region by Baker would underscore U.S. resolve to force Iraq out of Kuwait. On Thursday, Defense Secretary Richard Cheney said as many as 100,000 more U.S. troops may be sent to the Gulf in response to the continuing buildup of Iraqi forces in Kuwait. The State Department says Jordan is honoring trade sanctions against Iraq. That finding, after weeks of uncertainty, could lead to emergency U.S. aid to the Arab Kingdom. Barry Schweid reports from the State Department.
Spokesman Richard Boucher said the U.S. has had questions about Jordan's performance, but they were addressed, and Jordan indeed is observing the U.N. boycott of Iraq. Boucher suggested indirectly that Saudi Arabia provide help for Jordan. The Saudis cut off oil shipments when Jordan was vacillating. The Bush administration, meanwhile, is likely to provide special assistance to Jordan. The country is burdened with refugees and lacking hard currency, having trouble paying for imports. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
A number of hurdles remain before Congress can wrap up its work on a budget reduction pact and hit the campaign trail. House leaders are having trouble lining up enough votes to back raising taxes, and at least one White House official traveling with President Bush in California expressed concern about the state of negotiations, saying things are looking bad. Failure to pass the compromise budget would be a major blow for Congress and President Bush and throw the budget negotiations into disarray. Late this afternoon, problems remained over proposals involving Medicare and child care provisions. Three former Northwest Airlines pilots convicted of flying while intoxicated all received prison sentences today. The three men were the first people prosecuted under a federal law that prohibits operating a common carrier while under the influence of alcohol. Catherine Winter of Minnesota Public Radio reports.
Captain Norman Prowse received a 16-month sentence, while his two co-pilots, Joseph Balzer and Robert Kirshner, each received a one-year sentence. A jury found that the three were under the influence of alcohol when they flew a 727 from Fargo to the Twin Cities in March with 91 people on board. Federal Judge James Rosenbaum told the pilots they violated the public trust. He said alcoholism is not a license to kill. Captain Prowse acknowledged that he had endangered the public, but he says it's still safe to fly.
One of the spinoffs of this terrible experience that the three of us have been through is to alert pilots that they need to be more aware of this. And I've been very involved with pilots in recovery, and I know it's had an effect.
All three men plan to appeal their convictions. For National Public Radio, I'm Catherine Winter in Minneapolis.
On Wall Street, the Dow fell 48 points today. This is NPR News.
I'm Terry Gross. The AIDS epidemic has reminded us that viruses are hard to kill and their effect on the human body can be lethal. But for those of us who aren't scientists, it's difficult to understand why we can swallow an antibiotic to treat a bacterial infection, but there's no equivalent when we're the victim of a cold, the flu, or a more devastating virus. Viruses are explained in lay terms in a new book by Ann Giudice Fettner. She's been covering the AIDS epidemic from its start and has written about it for the Gay Press, the Village Voice, and Medical World News. She's also the author of the 1984 book The Truth About AIDS. AIDS activist Larry Kramer, the co-founder of Gay Men's Health Crisis, wrote the foreword to Fettner's new book Virus. He describes her as a hero, among the very few who knew exactly what was happening right from the start and interpreted it in exceptionally useful ways. Fettner writes, today is the day of the virus. Does that mean that viruses are more potent than they used to be?
I think probably they're not any more potent per se, but we've made changes, social changes, that and technological changes that have made a tremendous difference with this, Terry. For instance, we put viruses on intercontinental planes and take them into populations that have never been exposed to them before. And we are also learning a tremendous amount about viruses that we've never known before. I mean, they were just sort of filterable agents that no one could deal with until very recently.
What's the change that's happened recently? How can we deal with it now that we couldn't before?
Well, the interrelationship between viruses and the changes and the discoveries that have been made, for instance, in molecular biology, genetics, and so forth, really, it's a tremendous impact on virology to be able to take the genetic material of these not alive, not dead creatures, entities, and pull it out, look at it, decide what this gene does, that gene does, and so forth, to manipulate the genes, actually.
What is a virus?
Basically, it's just a strand of genetic material wrapped up in a protein envelope.
See, I don't think of viruses as genetic material. I think of them as germs, you know. So what does it mean that a virus is genetic material?
Well, all germs have got genetic material in them, but most of them, like the bacteria that we're so familiar with, have life cycles and of their own. They can reproduce. A virus has nothing except the program to reproduce, but to do so, it's got to get into the cell, take over the cell's own genetic machinery, and by doing so, reproduce itself. It is not concerned with the host. It doesn't, doesn't think, gee, here's a nice person. I'll hop in there and use this as a home. But we are simply a production company for a virus.
So a virus is kind of in a dormant state until it gets into a cell?
Yeah, in the book I use the analogy of a seed. I mean, a seed in a package is a potential. And a virus, really, until it gets into the cell that it infects, is just that.
Why is it that bacteria can be killed off pretty easily with antibiotics and science has been unable to find a way to kill viruses?
Well, basically, because a bacterium has its own little world. It has all of the genes it needs. It has an outer envelope, and it moves around in our bloodstream. But a virus, because of its reproductive mode, has to get into the cell, integrate into the cell itself. So when you're trying to kill viruses or when you're thinking about killing viruses, you're doing, in a way, the same thing you're doing when you try to kill a cancer cell or kill the cancer of a cell. You have to kill the cell. That's strong medicine.
How do vaccines work?
Vaccines work by alerting the immune system to the presence of, to the reappearance of any pathogen. In other words, there is a lag time between the time you get infected and the time you get sick in most instances and in all diseases. If your immune system is primed by previous exposure to that pathogen to recognize it, it immediately goes into an enormous attack and gets rid of it so that you don't have that lag time while the immune system builds up its recognition system. It's already there. It sees the pathogen again and goes after it. And many vaccines are simply weakened or attenuated forms of the pathogen, the bacteria, the virus, or so forth, that if they were not weakened would indeed make you sick.
Was it AIDS that got you interested in viruses?
Yeah, it really was. I was marginally interested. I mean, I'm sort of a general systems thinker, and I was sort of interested before. But AIDS has changed a lot of people's interest in virus and many other fields of medicine and research because it is an absolutely fascinating, ghastly, but fascinating whole family of viruses.
Before we talk more about AIDS and the reporting you've done over the years about AIDS, I want to ask you about some other viruses. Let me ask you about chronic fatigue syndrome. Are scientists sure that such a syndrome exists, and do scientists know if it's caused by a virus?
There's no question that such a syndrome exists, to greater or lesser degree in different people. probably the difference between those who become extremely sick, and they do, they have their immune systems are totally messed up, and the ones who don't get so ill are maybe an autoimmune or genetically mediated. There are a number of viruses have been implicated in this, which is, has confused it. For one, the Epstein-Barr virus was early on, you know, when they were calling it a yuppie disease, which, of course, denigrated it down to the point that it wasn't worth looking at. But recently, in Philadelphia, at the Wistar Institute, Elaine DeFreitas has identified the presence in many of these patients who are quite ill of one of the HTLV viruses. These are viruses in the same family to which the HIV/AIDS virus belongs. So that, and Gallo at the National Institutes of Health has identified another herpes virus that seems to be present in much greater numbers of people who have got this chronic fatigue syndrome. But this is not a pretend syndrome. These people are, some of them, desperately, desperately ill.
And the symptoms are what? Depression and fatigue, feeling like you can't even get out of bed?
Well, they range much further than that. I mean, they are growing things on their bodies that you see with a dysregulated immune system. They're getting cancers. They're getting serious autoimmune disorders. They are so allergic, some of them, that they can literally cannot go out of the house. I've seen some of these patients that are critically, critically ill, and with a range of symptoms. And so much of that, I think, depends on the genetic makeup of the individual.
Now, you just got back from a conference in Moscow on a possible viral basis of mental disorders. What's the state of the art thinking on the possibility of viruses being the cause of certain mental disorders?
Well, the conference itself was basically about the genetic underlying genetic predisposition to mental disorders. There's no question that viruses, I mean, we know that viruses can cause all of the symptoms of any mental disorder. And as we get further into these slow viruses or slow-moving viruses, like the HTLV family of viruses, there is more suspicion that some of these mental disorders may be caused by viral infection. We see it, you know, when you get a bad fever, you get really nutty. But some of them are thought perhaps to have affected infants when they were in utero, so that there is some deficiency laid in then. Viruses are going to, within the next 10 years, are going to explain a lot of disease entities that we really don't have any cause for at this time.
My guest is Ann Judici Fettner, and she's written a new book called Viruses, Agents of Change. She has an earlier book that's called The Truth About AIDS, Evolution of an Epidemic, and she's been writing about AIDS since the epidemic started. How did you start writing about AIDS?
Well, I got interested in it in a very roundabout way. I was working in Africa, working for the government of Kenya, trying to do health education, the lowest tech kind of possible health education, but given the circumstances in Kenya. And soon after I got back from Africa, I saw a notice that Kaposi's sarcoma was striking young gay men. I'd seen Kaposi's in Africa and knew that it did not strike this age group in this country. So I got really interested in that, and I'm very interested in the immune system and have been for a long time. So as this thing began rolling along in the middle of 1981, a year later, I just stepped back and said, wow, we're in big trouble here, and started a book on it. Everyone said, that's ridiculous. The doctors are going to solve it. I had no faith at that time in it.
Because you were one of the first writers to really be covering AIDS, you ended up writing a lot for the gay press. And you once said that you were always surprising people, being a straight, middle-aged woman. People were always expecting, you know, if you're a woman, that you're going to be like a young lesbian writing about it. What kind of surprising situations did that put you into?
Well, it put me into some funny situations. I mean, I was invited, for instance, to Mount Holyoke to to give a talk in the political department. And when I got there, I got off the plane. I had been speaking in Sweden, and I got off the plane in Boston, and I went over to Mount Holyoke. And I'm a, you know, a small, blonde, middle-aged woman with a lot of kids. And when I walked in the room, it was absolutely full of young, tough lesbians. And they were really horrified to see me come in. But, you know, that's crazy, too, because I am very politicized about this, and I was politicized early. I didn't go into AIDS because I had any particular bone to pick about anybody's sexual orientation. I'm like the British. I don't care what you do as long as you don't startle the horses. But I saw what was happening to these people, that no one cared whether they lived or died, and I got very, very militant about it. So, you know, I'm as well accepted by the gay community as I am by any.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about your research into AIDS. And my guest is Anne Fettner. She's written a new book on viruses. It's called Viruses, Agents of Change. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Anne Fettner. Her new book is called Viruses, Agents of Change. Let's get back to talking about AIDS. You had a recent article on the possible spread of AIDS through oral sex. And since you're continuing to research the subject of how AIDS is spread and what kinds of contact leave you most vulnerable, I thought I'd ask you about some of the latest information that we have. What is the latest thought about kissing and about oral sex?
Well, there are grades of danger in behaviors, and certainly the primary danger, behavioral danger in contracting HIV is IV drug abuse with an infected needle with infected blood in it, and certainly anal intercourse has been proven to be extremely dangerous. Vaginal intercourse is also dangerous, but probably not as much as anal intercourse. But, you know, this is a hard thing to prove. They found recently at the Dental Institute, at the National Institutes of Health, that saliva itself has a very interesting and potent effect on human immunodeficiency virus. If you take concentrations of this virus and let it sit in saliva for an hour, you cannot infect the cells that the virus normally infects with the virus. Somehow it is inactivated, or the cells are protected in some way by whatever the saliva is doing to them. So this puts, it would seem to me, this puts oral sex way down on the risk scale. Now, you cannot say it never happens, and it probably occasionally does, depending on whether or not there are, say, bleeding gums or maybe a heavy load of virus. But on a risk of 1 to 10, it is quite, quite low.
Well, but let me ask you this. If you're engaging in oral sex, and if the virus has to sit in saliva for an hour before the saliva neutralizes the virus, it seems to me you'd still be vulnerable.
That's the good question. And what they're doing now is repeating these kinds of experiments at different time frames. So you have a spectrum of time, say from 5 minutes up to an hour. I had asked that same question myself. You know, an hour is a long time for anything to sit anywhere. So they are repeating those. One of the interesting things about this is if indeed saliva has something in it, they think it's a big molecule that can stop this virus, then that's an extremely interesting molecule to identify, because it might be susceptible to be turned into some sort of preventive. So that's an interesting idea involved in this, and a good bit of research ongoing now.
What implications would this knowledge about the saliva saliva's effect on the virus. What implications would that have for kissing?
It probably, the human mouth, they say, is a really dangerous place in itself. It's full of enzymes and bacteria and so forth and so on. I would suspect that kissing is such a low-risk kind of thing to do that really it's not something to worry about. I mean, obviously, you're not going to go in with bleeding gums and kiss somebody who's dying of AIDS with your mouth open. But just in general, I would not worry about kissing per se. I mean, there's too much else to worry about.
Even heavy kissing?
Well, the Centers for Disease Control says, you know, they say, oh, well, maybe that's not good. But nobody knows that. And I think that this information about saliva probably sort of tips it to the less, very, very low risk. I mean, you know, you walk out on a public street, and your chances of getting run over on a freeway they're probably greater than the chance of contracting the HIV infection by kissing. Certainly, that would be low on my priority.
You recently returned from a conference in the Soviet Union. What were you able to find out about the extent of AIDS there?
Very little. I asked one of the psychiatrists in the hospital when they were showing us around if they were seeing AIDS dementia, which is the mental disorder that goes often with it. And he said no, and they weren't testing for it and so forth. They told me that they had 700 cases in Russia. However, a few weeks later, I spoke to Dr. James Alesky from Newark, who was one of the first to identify AIDS in children early on in 82. He had just come back from a very small town 500 miles out of Moscow. He had been over there in the hospital trying to help treat 78 AIDS babies. So if there are only 700 cases in the whole of Russia, and they're not doing any kind of education, I mean, they've got such monumental problems. I think they can't even get a fix on this. But with 78 babies in one hospital in a small town, there's no way to tell what the magnitude of the disease is over there. Just no way at all.
Are you suggesting you think that they're trying to cover up the problem?
Well, I think, yes, I think they are covering it up. I think that they don't have they are in many ways with a third world infrastructure. They don't have the wherewithal to go out and do any epidemiology. I mean, they are holding back the tide in that country. It's really surprising to me that they're in big trouble. And AIDS, I would certainly like to see more public information about it. I mean, there are a lot of young people and... You know, this is a country where there's not anything to do much after the lights go down, and you know that means sex and drinking.
So if there's more AIDS in the Soviet Union than they're willing to admit, that means that they're probably not doing enough education to prevent future spread.
Sure. Well, but they're only following the lead of every other country that's had AIDS pop up. I mean, nobody has wanted to admit it. This disease has been characterized as something morally wrong, which is absolutely ludicrous. Cancer used to be in the closet like this many years ago. I remember when I was a child, nobody would use the big C word. And now we've got another big, big bad word.
Do you think editorial standards have changed? You've been writing about AIDS since 1981. And in trying to alert the public to how the disease is spread, you have to be explicit about the ways people have sex, and that's not something that's usually allowed in the mainstream press or on most broadcasting. So do you think standards have changed at all?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the frankness has certainly come out. You mm-hmm. know, you remember, Terry, when we were first reading about it in the mainstream press, what we were hearing was, do not exchange bodily fluids.
Yeah, right.
Now, what that meant to a hormone-filled 15 or 16-year-old, I have absolutely no idea. It's ridiculous. I mean, you watch television, you see what kids are exposed to at night, and then you're pussyfooting about in their classrooms and the media and talking about in such an oblique fashion that unless you've got a college education, you don't know what they're talking about.
Earlier in our discussion, we were talking about what viruses are, how viruses are spread. Maybe you can explain why viruses are only spread in certain ways. Like with AIDS, there are certain ways that it will spread and certain ways it won't. You know what I mean? Like kissing isn't going to spread it as easily as, say, anal intercourse would. It's I think it's hard for us lay people to understand why some ways leave you more vulnerable than others.
Well, viruses have certain habits of their own. For instance, if you've got a cold and you sneeze and the virus gets on your hands and you leave it on surfaces and so forth, you're going to get a cold by contacting that virus, putting it into your own face, you know, as we do on subways and schools and so forth. Thank God, HIV is not spread that way. It is spread in exactly the same way that hepatitis B virus is, which means blood-blood contact. We do not catch it. You don't sneeze AIDS. You don't kiss somebody's cheek and get AIDS. You don't get it drinking after them and so forth. They all have, for instance, the cold, if you got a cold and you feel bad for a couple of days and then your chest begins to get one of those really infected feelings, it is not because the cold virus has moved down into your chest. It can't stand the heat that is generated in your chest. It probably means you've got another virus of a whole different kind. Moreover, all viruses have a certain type of cell that they are attracted to. The polio virus, for instance, only infects the cells in the gut. Now, from the gut, it may move to other cells within the body. But it took many, many years to determine that this was happening. So cells are tropic or attracted to certain kinds of cells, which, of course, is one of the reasons that they are useful in all of this new genetic engineering that's going on.
What do you think are the main AIDS stories on the horizon right now that need to be investigated?
Well, I certainly, with the push for vaccines is absolutely essential. I mean, you look, you know, perhaps in this country with our high-tech medicine, we're going to be able to keep people alive longer and longer and longer with better therapies and better care and so forth. But when you look into the third world and the fourth world countries where $2 per capita is all any of those governments have to spend on anybody, for everything, for all of their medical care, for building hospitals, for medications, for vaccination programs, we are really looking at a bloodbath in these countries. The virus in some places, like in Kampala, Uganda, that 78% of the blood donations were tested and found to be positive. We are going to lose an enormous generation of young people, of young productive people, and young educated people in third world countries. The push for a vaccine is of absolutely critical importance. They will sooner or later come up with one, but I really hold my breath about this.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about viruses.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Ann Judice Fettner, and her new book is called Viruses, Agents of Change. Next time, dancer and choreographer Bill T. Jones, who will soon premiere his new work, Last Supper at Uncle Tom's Cabin at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For many Americans, Paul Simon's album Graceland was their first exposure to world music. Coming up, world music commentator Milo Miles reviews Simon's follow-up album, The Rhythm of the Saints. It takes courage to run into a burning building to rescue someone. It takes a different kind of courage to keep writing stories when no one wants to publish you. Larry Brown has both kinds of courage, but now he's not only getting published, he's getting rave reviews. And this year he gave up firefighting to write full-time. Larry Brown joins us for a reading and interview. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg gives us some ammunition against pretentious people who overuse the word shall. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Although the end of the budget battle is supposed to be near, it's taking lawmakers a long time to iron out final details. Congressional and White House leaders are still working on a deficit-cutting package. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Negotiators are still having trouble putting together a package that will meet the goal of $500 billion in deficit reduction over 5 years. Pete Domenici, the ranking Republican on the Senate Budget Committee, said that the problem now was on the spending side, that more spending cuts were needed because the package was still about $10 billion short. And the White House Chief of Staff, John Sununu, reportedly said that if there weren't enough spending cuts in the budget to reach the $500 billion target, he would recommend that the president reject the bill. Senate Democratic leader George Mitchell said that the White House and Republicans want to cut more from Medicare and that Democrats are trying to defend the health insurance program. Despite these obstacles, congressional leaders say they expect to have a plan on the floor of the House as early as this evening and passed by the Senate by Sunday morning. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
And the White House says the president is sending Secretary of State James Baker to Saudi Arabia early next month for talks there with Saudi leaders. A White House spokesman denied that Baker will ask the Saudi government to approve military action against Iraq. Marlon Fitzwater says that no date has been set for the trip. It's believed the secretary will likely stop in Egypt and possibly other countries as well. A federal judge has sentenced Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry to 6 months in jail and a $5,000 fine. Barry was convicted this summer of one misdemeanor drug charge, acquitted of another, and the jury was deadlocked on the remaining 12 charges. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
Standing before Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson, Marion Barry said, "I'm nervous. My stomach is in knots. I'm truly remorseful." Judge Jackson said Barry's high office and his breach of the public trust required a sentence greater than would normally have been given to a first-time drug misdemeanor defendant. "You were a role model. You gave aid and comfort to the drug culture," Judge Jackson said. "Having failed as an example, the defendant must now be an example of a different kind." With that, the judge sentenced Barry to 6 months in prison, a $5,000 fine, and a year's probation. Barry has 10 days to appeal. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
Government-ordered inspection of the Trans-Alaskan pipeline will start this weekend after allegations of fraudulent testing for corrosion. 19 sections of the pipe will be inspected to see if unqualified workers with poor equipment failed to conduct proper corrosion testing. The 800-mile pipeline that went into operation in 1977 has been undergoing an $800 million repair job. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 48 points to close at 2,436.14 in light trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. World music started to catch on in this country with Paul Simon's 1986 album Graceland. It sold more than 2 million copies. For a follow-up, Simon shifted his musical focus from South Africa to South America. The results can be heard on his new album, Rhythm of the Saints. World music commentator Milo Miles says even though Simon sounds a bit strained this time, he's still riding the crest of the wave he created.
Down among the reeds and rushes, a baby boy was found. His eyes as clear as centuries. His silky hair was brown.
Never been lonely, never been lied to. Never had a scuffling fear, nothing denied to. Born at the instant, the church bells chime. The whole world was burning, born at the right.
When Graceland came out 4 years ago, I had a list of quibbles as long as my arm. The sounds and songs were wonderful, but what was that voice doing inside those rhythms, singing those songs? Would this record make people more interested in South African pop music, or simply interested in Paul Simon again? Can he really be as indifferent to the relationship between culture and politics in South Africa as he seems to be? Well, the answer to the last question is, sure enough, he's a staunch poetic romantic who doesn't think he should have to lose one more precious hair over those sticky political issues. But as for everything else, complaints about Graceland seem totally beside the point by now, and the vigor and beauty of the album have conquered all objections. South African pop benefited, world music as a whole benefited. And with his new Rhythm of the Saints, Simon doesn't have to worry about cultural boycotts. West African guitar styles and drum beats from Brazil and the Caribbean are available to all without any extra baggage. In fact, Simon's light tone and often lofty lyrics fit in better with the graceful pitter patterns he prefers on Rhythm of the Saints than with the chesty rumble of South African Mbakanga. After all, there's already many sylphs with a literary bent singing down South American way. Here's Simon with one of them, Milton Nascimento.
My hands were numb. A cup of herbal brew, then the sweetness in the air combined with the lightness in my head, and I heard the jungle breathe in the bamboo. So the sons, da licença, um momento eu te lembro que amanhã será tudo, será nada, depende de coração, será breve, será grande, depende da paixão, será sujo, será sonho, cuidado.
One of the best aspects of Simon's world music albums is that they're not imitation anything. For better or worse, they're products of his sensibility. Although he's never struck me as a rock and roller, he has an infinitely flexible feel for folk idioms and can give a warm, common touch to much abused techniques. For example, there are more studio professionals like the Brecker brothers helping out on Rhythm of the Saints than on Graceland. But the tracks are never merely slick and rarely slip into simple jazz Brazil fusions. Simon has said he wrote the lyrics to fit the rhythm tracks, which is a very liberating process for him on Graceland. The thrill of surprise has faded on Rhythm of the Saints, but even if Simon does get a little cosmic from time to time, his generational comments on wealth and aging add tang to the songs Born at the Right Time and The Obvious Child. And near the end of the album, he comes up with two tracks that are outright gorgeous.
Moves like a fist through traffic, anger and no one can heal it. Shoves a little bump to the momentum, it's just a little lump, but you feel it in the creases and the shadows. With a rattling deep emotion, the cool river sweeps the wild, wide ocean.
The Cool, Cool River is a song about idealism attacking social alienation. And though songwriter Simon distances himself from raw alienation, he knows it when he sees it, and he's smart to remind us that it lives on, healthy as ever. Alienation wins out in the end, but the quiet moments of optimism and hope in the middle of the number grab you first and ease you into the surging climax of his story.
Song dogs barking at the break of dawn, lightning pushes the edges of a thunderstorm. And these streets, quiet as a sleeping army, send their battered dreams to heaven, to heaven, for the mother's restless son, who is a witness to, who is a warrior, who denies his urge to break and run, who says, hard times I'm used to them. Speeding planet burns, I'm used to that. My life's so common it disappears. And sometimes even music cannot substitute for tears.
The final track is The Rhythm of the Saints itself, and here Simon combines the best of his old knack and his new flair. The chorus delivers a hook as attractive as, say, Mother and Child Reunion, and that should make it a radio staple. The lyrics do the best job of what Simon claims he set out to do, which is to communicate by sound and nuance rather than literal meaning. I think the song's about guardian spirits. In a dozen small ways, I also think The Rhythm of the Saints is a lesser album than Graceland. But on the title track and a few others, Simon is full of what the South Americans call duende, poetic magic.
If I have weaknesses, don't let them blind. Camouflage all I'm weary of. I could be sailing on seizures of laughter, or crawling out from under the heel of love.
Paul Simon's Rhythm of the Saints. Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This is Fresh Air. When Larry Brown sat down to write his first novel in 1980, he was a fireman in Mississippi with a high school education. For 5 years, he wrote late into the night while continuing to work as a fireman and holding down a second job to support a wife and two children. During this period, Brown completed 5 novels, which brought him only rejection slips. Then he started to write Dirty Work, which would become his first published novel in 1989. In a New York Times book review, Dirty Work was described as an unforgettable, unshakable novel. In it, griefs and joys are met not at a delicate, self-consciously artistic angle, but head-on, with a force that is both subtle and powerful, and above all, compassionate. In January of this year, Brown decided to quit his job to devote himself full-time to his writing. He's just come out with his 3rd book, a collection of short stories called Big Bad Love. This is an excerpt of his story, Falling Out of Love. As the story opens, the narrator and his girlfriend are walking down a road looking for help. Their car has 2 flat tires, and they're kind of lost and kind of angry at each other.
Sheena, baby, didn't hurt for me like I did for her. I knew it. I thought about shooting her first and me second, but that wouldn't have done either one of us any good. It wouldn't be nothing but a short article in the paper that strangers could read and shake their heads over, then turn to the sports. Love goes wrong. It happens every day. You don't need to kill yourself for love if you can help it, but sometimes it's hard not to. If we'd had inflated tires, I could have got her off over in the woods somewhere, put some Thin Lizzy on, told her how we could work it out. Told her not only to be my baby, but to be my only baby. Later, in the dark, we could have moved together. But she didn't love me, and I could see that finally, so I decided to be real nasty to her. I said, "You just don't want to listen to anybody." She said, "I about had it for your damn mouth." "Jamming," I said. "Kiss my ass," she said. "Make it bare," I said, hoping she would, but she didn't, and we walked off in different directions. I didn't know why something that started off feeling so good had to wind up feeling so bad. Love was a big word, and it covered a lot of territory. You could spend your whole life chasing after it and wind up with nothing. Be an old bitter guy with long nose and ear hair and no teeth, hanging out in bars looking for somebody your age. But the chances of success went down then. After a while, you got too many strikes against you.
You know, I find your story such a really interesting mix of kind of macho and sensitive in the sense that, you know, a lot of the stories about men like hanging out in bars, drinking in bars, picking up women, looking for love. On the other hand, so many of the men in your stories are really lost and very needy.
Yeah.
They're misguided. They're misguided,
yeah,
and lost.
True.
So can you talk a little bit about that mix of, you know, like macho and lost and misguided?
Well, that's always hard for me to answer. I try to explain it, and I don't really know if I know the answer myself. I guess it's because the way I observe people. And while these characters are creations of my imagination. I know people like this. I know people who are lost in the world and who don't have seem to have any, you know, proper place in it, and who have a hard time getting along in the world the way it is.
What got you started writing?
Well, to be honest, I thought when I started that it might be possible to make some money doing it. I had been a fireman for about 6 years, I guess. And I had, but mainly I had been a big reader all my life. Ever since I was a small child, I had loved to read. I didn't care anything about education. I just barely got out of high school. I failed English my senior year, as a matter of fact, and had to go to summer school to get my diploma. But I had been wondering about the process for a long time of how people learn to write. I knew that, you know, somebody sat down in a room somewhere with a typewriter and he started writing a novel. And he just made it out of nothing. I mean, there was nothing before he wrote the novel, and after he finished the novel, there was a book. And I wondered how people learned how to do that, and I wondered if I could learn how to do it. And so after I thought about it for a long time, I decided I would finally try it. I sat down and started writing a novel in 1980, you know, just about 10 years ago this month. And so I was under the impression that the novel would be published, you know, as soon as I finished it. And I mailed it off to a publishing house in New York, and of course it came right back. Nobody wanted it. And I sent it around enough times to realize that it was not going to be taken. And I said, well, I'll write another one. So I wrote another one. It wasn't taken either. And about that time it began to dawn on me that there was an apprenticeship period that a writer had to go through, and nobody really knew how long it would take. But I just decided that I was going to stay with it for as long as it took, because I had started enjoying what I was doing tremendously, inventing all these characters and situations.
What were your early stories and novels like? What were they about?
Well, the first one I wrote was about a man-eating bear in Yellowstone National Park. It was a place I'd never been to. The second one was about some boys up in Tennessee who were going to plant a big patch of marijuana and sell it. And the third one, I can't remember that much about it, but I burned it. It was so bad. And the fourth one was about a boxer, told from the first person. And the fifth one was about a one-armed guy who was a woodcutter, and he accidentally killed a game warden and got in a whole bunch of trouble over it. And I wrote those, I guess, between 1980 and 1985, yeah. Covered a period of 5 years there, and it was 1986 before I started writing Dirty Work.
You know, your story about the man-eating bear in Yellowstone National Park, there's a character in one of your short stories in the new collection who writes that story.
Yeah,
this is a character who's teaching himself how to write.
Yeah, I used that. I kind of stuck that in there on purpose. So that's basically the plot line of what my first novel was. But it was really poorly written, though. It's so bad that now I can't stand to look at it.
But you still have it.
I've still got it, yeah. I keep it as a reminder.
The first short story that you had published, I believe, was in Easy Riders magazine, which is a biker magazine.
That's right. That was in 1982.
Is that a magazine you used to read? I mean, how did you know about it?
Yeah, I used to read it, and I was trying to write in any kind of genre to get published. I was writing horror stories, supernatural stories, science fiction, murder stories, and biker stories, trying to sell something to Easy Riders. And after I sent them three or four stories, I had an idea for another one one day, and I think I wrote it one sitting on a Saturday in my kitchen and sent it off to them, and they bought it. It was a really, really great day.
What was that one about?
It was about a guy getting in some trouble with the law down in Georgia, down in Bacon County, Georgia. And I tried them with some more stories later on, but they never did take anything else. But at that point, I thought I had broken through, you know, made my big break. But it was two more years then before I sold anything else.
Was there an editor who encouraged you early on?
Well, there were a lot of editors who started writing me letters about my stories around 1984 and 1985. But it wasn't until 1987 that I met the lady who is my editor now, Shannon Ravenel at Algonquin. She saw a short story that I published in the Mississippi Review in 1987, and she wrote me a letter, and I didn't know that a publishing company called Algonquin existed, but she wrote me this really nice letter and said she liked my story a whole lot, and she was senior editor at Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, and she wanted to know if I had enough stories to make a book, to make a collection. And it was like, you know, it was just the greatest thing that had happened to me. And I wrote back, I said, yeah, I've got 100. How many would you like to see?
When you were a fireman, did you get any enjoyment out of the work? Was there anything that you liked about the job?
The best feeling about being a fireman is when you can stop a fire in somebody's home before it gets to the point that it damages all of their irreplaceable items, like pictures, you know, mementos, things like that. And the worst part is the deaths that you see. You know, that's always the worst thing, fire deaths.
Were you a good fireman? Did you think you were good at it?
I think I was. My only problem is that I'm fairly small physically. You know, I don't weigh but about 140 pounds, and often I worked alongside guys who weighed 200, 220 pounds. But mainly, I was a driver and a pump operator after I graduated up from being a nozzleman. Although, whenever we would have something, I would wind up in the house anyway most of the time. I finally made captain, and then I was, you know, I could oversee a whole operation then and sort of run the whole thing. So I was really involved in all the aspects of it.
All of your books so far have been published by Algonquin Books, which is a small press located in Chapel Hill. Mm-hmm. I think your work has been getting so much attention that you've probably gotten offers from larger publishing companies by now. Is that something that you would consider doing, or do you feel a certain loyalty to your editor and want to stay at that company as long as she's there?
Yeah, I'm happy where I am. Shannon has been really good to me. She brought me out of nothing. You know, I mean, I was writing, I was publishing a short story occasionally was all I was doing. And now my third book is out, and Algonquin has been really good to me, and I intend to stay with him.
Larry Brown's new collection of short stories, Big Bad Love, is published by Algonquin Books. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. The President and the Secretary of State will be reacting to Saddam Hussein's decisions to fortify Kuwait, and we'll be talking about that tonight. Also, Mayor Marion Barry, the mayor of the District of Columbia, was sentenced today. Republican candidates are having some problems around the country as a result of confusion in Washington. I have a piece on some reporting I did in California on term limits, a new idea voters are taking hold of, and music from cartoons.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Sometimes when an American wants to appear more cultured and upper class, they try to affect the Queen's English. But linguist Jeffrey Nunberg says these Anglophiles almost always get it wrong.
I got an invitation to a show at one of San Francisco's Tonier art galleries. A very classy piece of work, at least up to the announcement at the bottom, the gallery shall remain open until 8 p.m. on Thursday evenings. That probably wasn't what they meant, not unless the extended hours were required by law. What they meant to say was the gallery will remain open, but they tried to gild the frame and wound up with that most embarrassing of slips, the bungled Anglicism. The distinction between shall and will is the flower of what H.W. Fowler used to call the English of the English, but the rules are as tangled and thorny as an English bramble. For one thing, the meaning of shall and will changes according to the subject. You shall expresses an obligation or makes a promise. You will makes a simple prediction. If an Englishman tells you, you shall have your money, he means that he's going to pay you. But if he says, you will have your money, you can whistle for it. But in the first person, the meanings are reversed. Here it's I shall that makes the prediction, and I will that expresses promise or determination. The difference is summed up in the old story about a Frenchman foundering in the surf off Brighton who yells, help, I will drown, and no one shall save me, so nobody does. But it isn't only foreigners who have trouble with shall and will. The Scots and Irish don't bother with the distinction, a point that the English have historically taken as a clear indication of the mental deficiencies of the Celtic races. And in America, the English use of shall has never really taken root outside New England. As James Thurber wrote, men who use shall west of the Appalachians are the kind who twirl canes and eat lady fingers. Granted, it's a charming distinction, but Americans are bound to screw it up. Even General Douglas MacArthur got it wrong when he announced his intention to recapture the Philippines by saying, I shall return, where it was I will return that really expresses the determination he had in mind. It's not the kind of thing you can pick up in the course of a junior year abroad. As the 19th century Bostonian writer Richard Grant White put it, the distinction is too subtle for persons who have not had the advantage of early intercourse with educated English people, English in blood and breeding. But then, why would any self-respecting American want to touch this business with a barge pole? When I hear an American reaching for a shall, it puts me in mind of the flap that was raised a couple of years ago when a White House protocol officer was photographed curtsying to Queen Elizabeth. As one critic commented, we fought a war about that. Maybe Thomas Jefferson and Noah Webster were right when they suggested that we should have thrown the King's English over the side along with a king and called our language American or federal or some such thing. Then nobody would be tempted to assume that the English own the language just because it's named after them. And we might have been spared this game of linguistic upstairs-downstairs that's gone on 200 years too long. I like to believe that hell has its own American quarter, with a special circle set aside for Anglophiles, though, of course, they call it a roundabout. At its center is a cozy pub where one can park one's motor car, loosen one's braces, and chat over the controversies of the day, with one's legs crossed like Alistair Cook and one's file of facts in one's lap. But for everything that comes out of your mouth, you pay the price in what goes into it. For the place serves nothing but English food. You spend eternity drinking warm lager and eating fish and chips wrapped in grease-sodden newspapers, English newspapers still wet from the presses so that you can read about Di and Fergie on every piece of cod.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person. Amy Salat and Phyllis Myers produce our interviews with production assistance from Roberta Shurrock and Joan Tui. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bill T. Jones started out as an athlete and ended up a dancer and choreographer. He founded a company with Arnie Zane, who later died from AIDS. On the next Fresh Air, Jones talks with us about continuing their vision. Also, a talk with cellist Deirdre Murray about playing with some of today's most adventurous jazz composers. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.